It's great to be here. I thought I would start out by talking a little bit about epigenetics in general. I think it's probably no surprise to many people in this room that your DNA is not your destiny. And for those people like Alain and James with good genes, that may be a sobering thing, but for those of us with bad genes, it offers hope. Also with a lot of developmental biologists, you need no convincing that DNA is not everything. If we were to take a fibroblast from each person in this room and then have the ability to look at your Purkinje cells, you would see that these two cells have the same DNA, but obviously have very different morphologies and genotypes, and that's likely due to very different epigenetic signatures. So I thought, I'm a big believer in definitions, and I thought it's early in the afternoon, so you might be falling asleep, so I brought some props. As many of you know, in each of our cells, which is less than 10 microns, we squeeze in 3 × 10⁹ base pairs, that's haploid, with a helical rise of 3 × 10⁻⁸ meters. If you stretch out the DNA in a single cell, it stretches out to be 2 meters. Okay? In order for us to be able to fit that DNA into a cell, what it has to do, and this isn't a religious ceremony, it's wound, as you know, in higher chromatin structures around nucleosomes, which are 146 base pairs wrapped around 8 histone proteins. And if you take nothing away from my talk today, it's the simple idea that epigenetics is really the process of regulating the equilibrium between this open conformation and this closed conformation. And this closed and that interaction is governed, I think you'll hear about some of the more complex relationships, but it's governed really by 2 major components, that is chemical modifications of the DNA and chemical modifications of highly conserved N-terminal tails of histones. And what's really been surprising is that if you look at the proteins that govern this equilibrium, in this direction, HATs, and in this direction, HDACs, small molecule inhibitors of HDACs can actually have profound biological effects neurological systems. So this is just, again, a schematic diagram of this equilibrium, and what has been now understood is that if you look at the structure of many of the zinc-dependent hydrolases, also known as HDACs, these inhibitors all have a common chemical motif. They have a cap, a linker, and then they bind this zinc at the end. And these inhibitors have been used to show positive effects in many, many, many neurological conditions. These effects are likely due to effects on neuroprotection. This is a study we did almost 12 years ago, just looking at the mitochondrial toxin 3NP. You can see how you get these bullet lesions. If you treat with an HDAC inhibitor, the brain is completely resistant. These are more recent studies that we've done showing that HDAC inhibitors can actually foster intrinsic neuronal regenerative growth in the presence of cyclic AMP fairly dramatically. So you see about 5 microns versus 60 microns. And then there are studies by many others, and some of them are actually here, that have identified important effects of HDAC inhibitors on neuroplasticity. Studies by Marcel Wood, Lisa Li-Wei Tsai, and others. But I think these results beg many questions, and the one question that I want to talk to you about today is, how is it that the stress of injury actually is converted into changes in epigenetic proteins and then in changes in gene expression that are either adaptive or maladaptive? And what's been very surprising is that as people have looked, and again, this is a very nice review from Craig Thompson, who's now the head of Sloan Kettering, is that changes that many of the proteins that actually sit right above the genome and therefore are by definition epigenetic proteins are actually metabolic sensors. And the group of proteins that I'm going to focus on today to tell you about are a family of 2-oxoglutarate-dependent dioxygenases. These are metabolic sensors, epigenetic modulators, and transcriptional regulators. So some of you have probably heard about these proteins, but I think they've begun to unravel really interesting and exciting areas of biology. So one of the classes of proteins is a group of proteins called the 10-11 translocation proteins, the TETs. These proteins actually stick a hydroxyl group onto methylcytosines and facilitate the demethylation of DNA. So we thought that the dogma was is that in utero, you get your DNA methylated. That sets down exactly what genes are going to be transcribed through lifetime. We now know that these proteins have the ability to demethylate DNA very dynamically and thus form a basis for plasticity. The Jumanji-type oxygenases, these are histone demethylases, so they affect post-translational modifications of histones, and they have the ability to hydroxylate methylcytosines and thereby demethylate lysines and the terminal tails of histones. And they're given their term Jumanji because if you knock out the Jumanji proteins, you get a Jumanji-like cross in the neural tube. Finally, the hypoxia-inducible factor prohydroxylases. These enzymes hydroxylate specific prolines on a target transcription factor, which I'll tell you a lot about. Now, what's interesting about all of these enzymes is they're all oxygen, iron, and 2-oxoglutarate dependent. As many of you know, oxygen is critical for the ability to generate ATP in all the cells of our body. Iron is an essential cofactor for iron sulfur cluster proteins in the mitochondria, as well as many other processes in the cell. And 2-oxoglutarate is a cellular intermediate generated both in the cytoplasm and in the mitochondria, which is kind of a marker of metabolic health. So, and this just tells you a little bit of the phylogeny of these different 2-oxoglutarate-dependent dioxygenases. I'm going to focus my story on this group of proteins, but I think it's really important to really think about why is it that all of these proteins with these functions would share this metabolic signature. So for those of you who aren't used to thinking about oxygen, remember that oxygen is essential for the efficient generation of ATP as the terminal electron acceptor in the mitochondrial electron transport chain. And under conditions of hypoxia, that is the situation where oxygen demand and supply are discrepant, there are a whole host of elegant adaptive mechanisms that develop in our body. The best example being if you go to a high altitude, you have the transcriptional upregulation of erythropoietin, which increases red blood cell mass, allows you to deliver more oxygen to cells, and relieves this discrepancy. Neovascularization, increased VEGF in the process setting of ischemia or hypoxia. Upregulation of VEGF, increased angiogenesis, increased delivery of blood to tissues, increased oxygen delivery. Finally, increased transcription of glycolytic enzymes in cells that are hypoxic. So you can't generate ATP through the mitochondria. You upregulate all your glycolytic enzymes and you generate ATP anaerobically through increased glycolytic flux. So Greg Semenza, working at Johns Hopkins in the early 90s, did a series of elegant experiments where he took the 5' non-coding region of the EPO gene and the 3' non-coding region of that gene, and he made a series of transgenics and identified an 8 base pair sequence in the 3' non-coding region of the EPO gene that was required for the induction of EPO in response to hypoxia in vivo. He then took that 8 base pair sequence and made a DNA affinity column. And through a series of heroic experiments involving 250 liters of CHO cells, he purified the factor that actually binds to that sequence. And that factor is hypoxia-inducible factor 1. It's a heterodimer consisting of a HIF-1 alpha subunit, which is the regulated subunit, and a constitutively expressed HIF-1 beta subunit. And it's a basic helix loop helix protein. It has this heterodimerization domain known as a PAS domain found in the period protein and the Drosophila single-minded protein. Amazingly, it's induced by every thing that is known to mimic hypoxia, iron chelators as well as cobalt chloride. And there are HIF consensus sequences in all the genes in the genome that you would want to be upregulated if your body were hypoxic. It really is truly an elegant response. And although EPO expression is limited, as you know, to the kidney, the liver, and now astrocytes, HIF is expressed in every single cell of our body. And HIF, it's now known that it regulates the synthesis of more than 100 genes that, as I said, act at a cellular, a local, and a systemic level to alleviate the discrepancy between oxygen demand and supply. This is an adaptive response that has evolved over millions of years and is incredibly elegant because it involves every single gene you would want for this stress response. So we now know a lot about, from the work of many people, Peter Radcliffe at Oxford and Bill Kalin in Boston, that what happens is that under conditions of normoxia, the HIF prol hydroxylases, the enzymes that I told you about, which are iron and oxygen dependent, normally hydroxylate HIF1 on proline 564 and proline 402. That recruits the von Hippel-Lindau protein, which is an E3 ubiquitin ligase, tags HIF for ubiquitination and degradation. Under conditions of hypoxia, the KM of this enzyme for oxygen is such that it doesn't function. HIF1 is stabilized, it translocates to the nucleus, dimerizes with its partner, and activates this adaptive response. The HIF prol hydroxylases began as single genes in flies and worms, and they've now diverged to three genes that are present in different subcellular localizations. I can tell you more about their enzymology if you're interested. So just to summarize, because this is important, HIF is constitutively stabilized, and under normoxia, it's degraded by the HIF prol hydroxylases. Under conditions of hypoxia, the PHDs are inhibited, HIF is stabilized, and activates its adaptive response. And the idea that we've been pursuing in my lab is that if we can pharmacologically or molecularly manipulate the switch, we can turn on this adaptive response at times when we either anticipate ischemia or when we feel that it hasn't been adequately activated enough to cause a disease. So the idea is that if you could inhibit it, then you can activate the response and then trigger adaptation. Let's see, I'm going the wrong way here. All right, so this is the model. The idea is you can fool the cell into thinking it's hypoxic when it's not and activate this adaptive response. Okay, so let me tell you the disease model that we've kind of focused on to really address the import of this model, hemorrhagic stroke. Many of you are familiar with ischemic stroke, where you have occlusion of a blood vessel leading to deprivation of glucose and oxygen. In this case, you have bursting of a blood vessel, releasing blood into, in this case, the striatum. This accounts for 10 to 20% of strokes. And even though it's a less common form of stroke, it's a form of stroke that has higher morbidity and mortality. The mechanisms of hemorrhagic stroke largely in the immediate, so this is a CT scan you can see, and like the bone, the blood is phase bright. You can see the increasing blood in the striatum. And in the immediate period after the stroke, you have swelling, and which causes problems, and also the effect of the electric static jet from the blood affecting the parenchyma. Many interventions to affect in this acute period have been unsuccessful. So what people have started to do, including our own labs, is to focus on the second injury mechanisms really resulting from the lice blood. And the idea is that you have the lice blood releasing hemoglobin, and then its component parts, heme and its oxidized form, hemin, which is then specifically taken up into different cell types where it's metabolized and causes toxicity, cell death, and actually failure of repair. So we've asked the question, if we turn on this hypoxia signal transduction pathway, can we enhance the recovery from hemorrhagic stroke? And the way that we actually induce hemorrhagic stroke in these mice and rats, I'll show you, is to inject a bacterial enzyme called collagenase, which breaks down the basal lamina of blood vessels and releases blood over time into the striatum, much in the same way it does in humans. We've then made triple conditional knockouts of the prolyl hydroxylases. Remember that there are three isoforms with different subcellular localizations, but with redundant functions. And the idea was to be able to conditionally reduce the expression of these enzymes only in the striatum. We used a TD tomato reporter line to show that when we inject AAV-Cre but not AAV-GFP, we get a really nice recombination in the mediolateral striatum where we inject our collagenase. We then did this recombination with AAV-Cre or GFP as a control, and after 2 weeks we induced a hemorrhagic stroke and looked at a variety of downstream parameters. And we were able to demonstrate that the Cre virus was able to cause recombination and reduction of levels of PHDs throughout the striatum. And as I mentioned, if you inhibit this enzyme, you should expect to see increases in HIF-1 targets. And we saw a significant increase in vascular endothelial growth factor and EPO in the striatum of these mice. We then looked at functional recovery using a variety of different behavioral outcomes. As many of you know who've done studies with Parkinson's disease, that normally if you put a mouse in a corner, it uses its whiskers and it will randomly go to the right or left. But if you cause damage in one striatum, it will have a bias towards one side versus the other side. We also, this is a form of spatial neglect. We also did a tape removal task, which is a form of sensory neglect. You put tape on both paws, and you find that if there's damage to the striatum, that there will be differences in the time the animal takes to remove the tape. What you see here is that when you have GFP, you have this significant bias, and it's significantly corrected with inhibition of the HIF-PHDs. We also saw improvements with the tape removal task, although it was limited to day three. So we concluded that reducing PHD expression improves functional recovery when looking at somatosensory dysfunction. So we also did these studies. We did these studies in rats in a different model in a different institution. Actually, that comes later. This is a molecular deletion, which is 2 weeks before. The question is, does this have any relevance for therapeutics? Likely not, because you really need to treat afterwards. So we developed a selective inhibitor of the HIF-PHDs that penetrates into the CNS. And the way we did this is we developed a novel cell-based assay to screen for selective HIF-PHD inhibitors. I won't tell you about it in terms of time, but we screened 85,000 compounds at Rockefeller in a month and identified a compound that was of particular interest to us, the branch oxyquinolones. These are the backbone of these compounds has actually been in phase two for humans. Cleoquinol has been moved forward by Ashley Bush and Rudy Tanzi. And we named our drug Adaptiquin because it's a hydroxyquinoline, but it has this ability to drive the adaptive response to hypoxia. So you can see here, compound 8 is Adaptiquin. You can see it stabilizes HIF, and it also upregulates all the HIF-dependent genes in a human neuronal cell line. And again, we did this in collaboration with Chuck Curran. This just shows the chemical structure of Adaptiquin fitting into the active site. And in collaboration with Chris Schofield at Oxford, we've shown that Adaptiquin, compound 8, can actually bind directly to recombinant HIF-PHDs, and it inhibits the HIF-prolyl hydroxylases in a test tube, suggesting a direct interaction of our drug with our target. So, as you know, many drugs fail in CNS testing because they don't get across the blood-brain barrier. What we did is we took advantage of mice that have the oxygen-dependent domain of HIF-1 linked to luciferase. So if you take 123 amino acids from HIF-1, which is the degron, and you stick it to luciferase, now luciferase will take on all the properties of HIF-1. You can express that through a ROSA26 locus in mice and use in vivo bioluminescence imaging to see where HIF is stabilized in vivo. And you can see here's the pseudocoloring of our bioluminescence imaging. Here's very low levels with vehicle. And as you increase the concentration of the drug, you see it in the liver, in the kidney, and in the brain. And this is the quantification. As you know, this is a two-dimensional image of a three-dimensional object. So we're always concerned that we're looking at dural or skin luciferase. So what we did is we took the lysates outside of the brain. We actually measured luciferase, and you can see we saw increases in all regions of the brain, as well as in the kidney and the liver. Interestingly, canonical HIF-PHD inhibitors failed to get into the CNS, and so the question was, what is the effect of this drug in our collagenase model given 2 hours post-injury and then 7 days, every day for 7 days? We found that, in fact, when we gave the adaptoquin, this is degenerating cells in the control mice. This is with ICH. You can see all these fluoro-jade positive neurons, and then a reduced number with the AQ. This is the quantitation using stereology, and you can see significant and dramatic reductions both in the hematomal and the perihematomal region. We then looked at behavior, and as expected, again, let me remind you that with the ICH, you get this bias almost completely abrogated with the drug. And again, significant but less robust improvements with the tape removal task. So a major complaint of drug companies in interacting with academic labs is that they often can't reproduce what we do. And so we thought, as a test of robustness, we would send the drug to a different lab in a different country to test in a different model in rats. And so it was looking at autologous blood injection in rats with the same paradigm, 2 hours and then 7 days, and then looking not only at tissue analysis, but single pellet reaching, an ecologically meaningful motor task, 7 to 11 days and 25 to 28 days after injury. And this is just a picture of the single pellet reaching task that many of you are familiar with. What you should note here is that at baseline, there was no difference between the AQ and the IC and the vehicle treated animals, but early on and late after testing, significant improvements in single pellet reaching out to 28 days. So it was administered post-injury, it reduced death and improved functional outcomes at 7 days in a collagenase model, as well as in a IC in an autologous blood model out to 28 days. So it begs the question of what's the mechanism. As I said, our hypothesis was that the drug is inhibiting the HIF-prol hydroxylases and turning on this adaptive response. And it just goes to show I've never generated a hypothesis that's been correct in my lab. It always seems like we're off. When we actually inhibited HIF-1, So this is just siRNA experiments that we did with multiple isoforms of HIF-1. You see we get a dramatic reduction in HIF-1 stability, no effect on toxicity due to hemin in vitro or the effects of any of our inhibitors, suggesting that the protection is somehow HIF-1 independent. So what is it? So that's when we went back to our in vitro model. This is actually an in vitro model of oxidative stress that my lab has been studying for a long time. And what we asked is we said, okay, what's the lowest concentration of drug that we can use? And what's the widest therapeutic window we can find? And then let's go back and start to do some therapeutic, some transcriptomics using non-protective and protective concentrations. So here you see that adaptoquin completely blocks oxidative death at 1 micromolar. And you can add it up to 16 hours after adding glutamate in this case. This is a glutamate analog, and protect all of the cells. And this just shows you the magnitude of the protection. So this is control. This is with the oxidative stress. These are all lives stained with calcium AM, thiidium homodimer, all are dead. But with adaptoquin, all protected. So what we did is we went to 14 hours, and we took protective and non-protective concentrations of the drug, and we did transcriptomics in collaboration with Giovanni Coppola at UCLA. And I'll just summarize the results of these transcriptomic data. So not surprisingly, oxidative stress induces transcriptional changes. About nearly 50% of those changes are normalized by our drug. We actually did used data on known HIF targets to show bioinformatically that adaptiquin doesn't work on HIF-1 targets, but rather works on this transcription factor, ATF4. And strikingly, 17 out of the 22 genes, 77%, including ATF4 itself, were changed in the same direction as ATF4 knockout neurons, strongly suggesting that this treatment acts via the suppression of ATF4-dependent pro-death genes. So what is ATF4? Many of you may be familiar with leucine zipper transcription factors. This is their dimerization domain. It's a transcription factor that's involved in amino acid metabolism, redox state, and ER stress response. Previous studies from our lab have shown that if you knock out ATF4, you can dramatically enhance, create resistance of neurons to oxidative stress. And we've shown that in vitro and in vivo. So if you take the ATF4 null mice, their vessels are completely normal. But if you look at the level of infarction after MCAO occlusion, this is a standard ischemic type of death. You see the large infarct by TTC staining, which is almost completely abrogated in the absence of ATF4. So we wanted to know whether ATF4 is adaptiquin working upstream of ATF4 or at ATF4. And we did some viral experiments in vitro. These are cortical neurons. In vitro, if you force expression of ATF4, all the cells die. If you treat with adaptiquin, you can completely block this death, suggesting that adaptiquin is actually working directly at ATF4. So our transitional model was that adaptiquin is inhibiting the HIF prolidoxylases, stabilizing HIF1, and upregulating pro-survival genes. Our new model is, in fact, that what adaptiquin does is to inhibit the HIF prolidoxylases and inhibit the hydroxylation of a variety of different proteins, some epigenetic, some transcriptional, and some involved in transcription itself, that ultimately affect the expression of oxidative stress-induced pro-death genes. I'll just finish by saying that in looking through phylogeny, you can see that these prolines on HIF that are hydroxylated are actually present in the C-terminal region of ATF4, and there are some of the similar motifs in these two proteins. So what we did is we took the motif and we mutated these prolines to alanine just to ask the question of, if you mutate these prolines, will you abrogate the ability of ATF4 to actually induce death? Much like if you mutate these prolines, you can affect the HIF, the oxygen-dependent stability of HIF1. And in fact, the answer is yes. So you see here that when you expose the cells to oxidative stress, you get death. And with the P to A ATF4, there is a significant improvement in survival. So adaptiquin blocks cell death induced by forced overexpression of ATF4, and the P to A ATF4 mutation protects the neurons from death. So I'm going to stop there. I hope that I've shown you that there are these very interesting groups of enzymes that have the ability to sense oxygen and, I will tell you, iron and 2-oxoglutarate. And if you you can use these enzymes potentially as metabolic switches that allow you, by manipulating them, to activate adaptive responses that ultimately can enhance functional recovery in the nervous system. And there are a whole host of these, so this is a area of research that is exciting and just emergent. I'll stop by acknowledging members of my lab, which has become much smaller as I've taken on more administrative duties. This work has really been driven by Sirvanan Karpagunder, who's a junior faculty in the lab, a number of the Burke faculty, and also, as many of you know, doing good science takes a village, and many of our collaborators around the world, including those at many institutions in Europe. So I'll thank you for your attention and be happy to take questions.